From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when the CIA promoted one of its own to become chief of disguise. For Jonah Mendez, this was a big deal. A woman who had come to the CIA supporting her husband. The CIA work culture had prioritized men and often kept women in secretarial work. But that was mostly boring to Mendez. She wanted something more stimulating. She was willing and happy to travel. She wanted to do something that felt valuable. And so when she was promoted out of secretarial work to do work in photography, that sounded interesting enough. And it turned out CIA photography was not exactly like Kodak cameras in the 1970s and 80s. The CIA was busy hiding cameras inside pens and other common items. If you're a James Bond fan, the comparison here is Q, and Mendez's work got ever more creative. Her team was working on everything from dual-purpose sex dolls to secret containers to bring Russian defectors across borders. Mendez tells it all in her new book, In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA, Unmasked. I should say, she doesn't exactly tell it all. There are cases in which she can't reveal exact locations or some other details. After all, people can still be vulnerable. But there is plenty that Mendez can and does reveal. It's a fast-moving book, and it is not her first. She co-authored Argo, the book that became an Oscar-winning film a decade ago. Her co-author was her late husband, Tony Mendez, who would be played on screen by Ben Affleck. And throughout her career, Jonah Mendez has not been fazed by ostensible glass ceilings. She has built a remarkable life, and today she is in Rochester as a guest of the World Affairs Council. But first, she is here with us, and it is an honor to have Jonah Mendez here, the former CIA chief of disguise with us. I think it's you. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And the name of this book, In True Face, you have said at a number of your events that you weren't exactly sure if the general public would understand what that meant right away. I think it's pretty clear, but you want to describe what you mean by In True Face.
I always thought In True Face was a phrase we used in the disguise labs when someone would come to see us and say, you know, I have an operational scenario, I have a situation, I need a disguise. They would typically walk into our labs in true face. That's sort of the starting point. That's without any makeup, without a mask, it's just who you are.
What you look like when you roll out of bed in the morning, I guess.
A little better than that, but not much.
Okay. We are going to spend some time this hour kind of pulling back the curtain on some of the work that you've done, because you have done that in this book. I asked you before the program began if that was bothersome to any of your former colleagues, current folks who you know who are still working, because I know that you're very careful in this book not to make anyone vulnerable.
It's tricky when you've lived your life undercover in a variety of names, in a variety of scenarios. It's tricky to try and put it all down on paper in a book. I'm amazed that the CIA has been as receptive to this book. It's not uncritical of the CIA, but everyone from Mike Morrell, who was a deputy director, David Priest, who used to do the president's daily brief, almost all of the information I received from the CIA has been very, very accepting. I think they like this book. I hope they like this book, because if they take it to heart, they'll get back to work on kind of fixing some of the errors in the way they handle their women employees.
How much of that had changed? At one point in the book, you described yourself as an equal of the men that you worked with. And then there was certainly a point where that would not have happened in the CIA. So how much do you suspect things now? I know you're retired from the CIA now, but how much is different when you compare from 30, 40, 50 years ago?
Well, I've said more than once that I think CIA, when I was there, was representing the American workplace writ large. It wasn't just happening at CIA, this sort of repression of women and not recognizing their value. It was broad and across a lot of technologies. I think at CIA they've been sensitized now. They've received so much criticism for the way they treated the women, starting with Tim Weiner. I quote him in the book, a man who wrote one of the best reviews of this book I've read yet, where he the quote that I give in the book is that he said some time ago that there is no element of the United States government other than the clandestine service of the CIA that treats its women so poorly. He meant it then. I'm not sure that's still quite true. I think women are moving forward, but I think it's pressure from outside of the agency that's helping that movement to increase.
By the way, the review that Jonah Mendez is talking about from Tim Weiner, who's now with the Washington Post, I believe.
Yes, right.
But has worked for the Times, and he hasn't always been the biggest cheerleader for the CIA. Well, I mean, journalists are not supposed to be cheerleaders. He's been quite a critic of the CIA, yes?
He's been very critical of the CIA, in that we didn't really consider him to be a friendly face. But I have to say, after I read his glowing review of my new book, I've somewhat changed my opinion of him. Thank you, Tim, wherever you are.
The book is out now, and I will tell you that it's a really valuable document of American history. It's also just a very fast, enjoyable read. It's called In True Face, and Jonah is the co-author of Argo. I mean, I don't know that you get enough credit. And you said before the program, well, that's okay. You know, you and your late husband did some work together. I've got another book at the table here that I have not read called The Moscow Rules, The Secret CIA Tactics That Helped America Win the Cold War. So you've done a lot of writing over the years. This is not your first book, but what do you hope the public will take if they go all the way through In True Face? What do you want them to understand?
You know, I wrote In True Face during COVID. If you go around asking people what they did during COVID, a lot of people accomplished things that they might not have thought they could otherwise. But during COVID, I was in the gym in my building much more often than normal. And I was on a treadmill, and a woman who I really didn't know very well, she came in, she's on the treadmill, we're talking. She said, oh, you know, you're retired? Yes, I'm retired. Where did you work? CIA. And this is an educated woman who is of a certain age. She has her wits about her. She reads. I know this for a fact. She looked at me and said, you worked at CIA with those murderers and assassins? And I looked at her like, I can't say her name. I was like, you need to read some more. You need to read my book when I finish it. But just the idea that perception is out there today just floored me, and it spurred me on to write some more.
Well, certainly there's also in American politics over the last 8 years or so, there's been, at least to my read, an increased hostility toward clandestine services, CIA, American intelligence. I don't remember the first time I heard the word deep state, but I hear it all the time now. You've got a kind of a wry smile on your face. So that's another term that I'm sure you've heard bandied about. What do you make of that?
I don't think when they say deep state, they're talking just about the CIA.
No.
They're talking about the United States government and not trusting the government. I don't believe they've ever really trusted the CIA because we always keep a screen up in front of what we're doing. We can't do it in public. It doesn't work if it's in public. I was saying to someone this morning that it's like watching a magic show. It's fascinating, but you cannot look behind the screen, behind the curtain, or it falls apart. People are attracted to what they can't see, what they don't know. It's very easy to be critical of something when you don't know all of the bits and pieces, but when you can't know them, it's frustrating. I think that's part of where the deep state comes from.
So let me talk, let's go through parts of, I want you to tell some stories from your book, but take us back first to why you ended up with the CIA in the first place.
Well, I didn't appoint myself at it. It wasn't like somebody launched me at the CIA. I went to Europe. I'm from Wichita, Kansas. I was in school. I was in college. My best friend got married in Fulda, Germany. Fulda is where we always expected the Soviets, if they ever actually did a ground attack on Europe, they were going to come through the Fulda Gap. And the fiancé of my best friend was in the 5th Armored Cavalry with a bunch of tanks. He was there guarding the gap. So I thought, well, that sounded much more interesting than the classes I was taking that semester. So I went to be in a wedding. And we left the church in tanks. and wedding dresses and bridesmaid dresses and bouquets and tanks. I think we went through a few German fields and destroyed them. And then they went to Italy on their honeymoon. So I was there. And I looked around Germany and I loved it. And I didn't want to go back to Wichita. I just kind of made a snap decision. I took a train to Frankfurt, the closest big town, a banking town. I got off in the Hauptbahnhof, the main train station. Got some Deutschmarks and a phone book and started calling, cold calling American banks. I made 4 phone calls. American Express, Bank of America. There was another C. The 4th one was Chase Manhattan. And told them I was looking for a job. And they kind of put me through a ringer, like, do you have a work permit? Do you speak German? Never worked in a bank? No, to all of that. And they said, well, come on down and talk to us. And I did, and they hired me, which was the beginning of a series of moments in my life that are unexplainable. Why in the world did they hire me? But they did. And that gave me an income. It gave me a salary. It gave me a way to stay. And through working at that bank, I met a group of Americans who were not military. There was a huge military, American military presence there at the time. But these were civilians, they said. And I had no reason to suspect anything. So I started dating one of them. And his parents lived in Vienna, Austria. He was American. His dad was a diplomat at the embassy there. And we went skiing. We went to wine festivals. It was actually, it was wonderful. And then he proposed to me in the subway station in Vienna with a poem. I was so charmed. I said yes. It wasn't until after I said yes, he said, by the way.
There's something else you should know.
There's just one little thing. He said, I'm not actually a civilian working with the military. I'm an undercover CIA officer, and your life is about to change dramatically. I was up for it. I was okay.
I mean, you still had time to say no at this point.
Well, I could always say no. I'm perfectly capable of saying no, but I didn't. When he talked about what it would mean and where we would go, and I thought it sounded fascinating, and it was.
The CIA at the time... Well, what was life like for women in the CIA at the time?
I didn't know how it was for them. I was hired as contract secretary overseas. It's a unique position. You don't get hired as a contract here in the States. It was convenient for the CIA. They needed a secretary. I was a really good secretary. So they put their arms around me and pulled me in the door. It wasn't until I got home and started looking around at how it worked and what's this secretary thing? How do you get out of this secretary thing? There wasn't a clear path. It took a couple of years to figure out how to undo the secretarial piece of it.
When did you really feel like you were finally on a path to doing interesting work? Was it in photography? I mean, you want to take us through a little bit of that, the route that you ended up taking that led to the chief of disguise?
It's a path. You have a minute?
Yeah, we've got time. That's why you're here.
I started as a secretary back in the States. Now I'm a staff secretary. A good one. And I say this more than once because later on I kept trying to find good secretaries to work for me, and it was hard to find good secretaries. I was working in the queue of OTS. OTS is Office of Technical Service. It is the equivalent of James Bond's Q at CIA. We did every technical gadget, tool, toy you can think of, and then we'd think of some new ones and we'd do them. If you needed it, we'd get it. If it wasn't available, we would make it. If it didn't exist yet, we would invent it. I worked with a group of physicists, chemists, electrical, mechanical engineers, battery specialists, people in disciplines so narrow that they wouldn't be recognized as a career outside of CIA. Hot air balloonist, about working on ink for your entire career. I mean, just It was broad. So I'm working with these engineers, and I discovered that they can't write. Well, I can write, and I can type. So I'd have them come and sit down at my desk, and they would dictate their trip reports to me, and I would type them as fast as they dictated them. They'd be on the boss's desk, you know, in a couple of hours. And everyone loved it. The engineers started getting rave reviews for their reports. The boss was happy because the work was flowing, and I was learning how to run some major programs and projects in the CIA. That was step one. If you flash forward about 4 years, I was working for the director of that office. It's about 1,000 people, all of Q, which is R&D is one half of it. That's the engineers. And the other half of it is operational people who would take the equipment and deploy it in the field. So I'm working for the director, and I was bored. So he didn't need a secretary. He did everything verbal. He taught me how to do New York Times crossword puzzle in ink. And I could see out my window, I could see the Smithsonian Castle building. And one day he was out there with coffee, and I said, you know, I'm thinking that I could find something at the Smithsonian that would really be interesting, something I could sink my teeth into, something with more substance. I look back at that now thinking, oh my God, what was I thinking? But I was thinking that I was bored and wanted to leave. He said,
why do you feel like, what was I thinking?
It just seems I'm looking for substance, and I'm sitting in the middle of one of the more substantial offices that I would ever be in, where we're operating around the world trying to shift history into the right spots. And here I'm wanting the Smithsonian. He said, why don't you take some of our photo courses? I know you like photography. I know you're an avid photographer. Take some courses. So I said, yes. And the first course, I went to a little airstrip outside of Washington, D.C., and this little twin-engine plane was out there. There was a man on a ladder with a bucket of paint, painting out the tail number so they couldn't report us. They had taken the doors off the plane, two little doors, one on each side. You could see the harness that was in there hanging for me. The pilot got in and turned it on. They handed me a 35-millimeter camera with a 1,000-millimeter lens, which back then was, I don't know, it was 18 inches long. It was huge. So that made the camera very hard to stabilize. That was part of the point. Because this course was called Airborne Platforms. And they're giving you a wobbly camera and putting you on a vibrating airplane and asking you to take pictures of that Ford pickup going down some dusty road, kicking up dust at 60 miles an hour. Can you make out the license plate? Can you photograph that license plate? Everything from the train signals along the tracks. We flew along with some geese. We went out over water. I said something like, in my headphone, I said, how low can we actually go? I swear I could have put my foot out the door and it would have gotten wet. It was just a wonderful, amazing day of flying, taking photos. That night, I'm down at the farm. There's no classes going on, so the dark rooms were mine. The dark rooms are like, I don't know, huge. And I'm developing and printing and hanging up prints on clotheslines. I've got big band music on real loud. And I thought, I could trade the secretarial thing for this. This is good. Yeah, I think I'll stay. That was the beginning. That was a huge change. That was a great boss who said, we don't want to lose you. Why don't you wander over here and see if there isn't something there for you?
And so when it comes to the kind of work you had to do in photography, can you describe some of the creativity that you had to deploy for? I think at one point you say a lot of your career has just been about figuring out what agents need and, you know, getting it to them, you know, whether that's a face, and we'll talk about that coming up here, a camera and a pen. I mean, can you describe some of the creativity that you deployed there?
Well, let me just tell you about the entry level. My first day working overseas in a photo office with big dark rooms and a bunch of men, it's all men, it was always men, they handed me a roll of film and a Nikkor reel and a steel can. This is how you developed film back then. They said, load this on the reel in the dark room and then come out and talk to us. So I went in, and what they had given me was aerial reconnaissance film. It's not normal film. This is stuff that went up like in the satellites. This is film without the backing on the film. The backing is removed. That's just to stabilize the emulsion. To put it on a Nikkor reel, I couldn't do it again. But I did it because I discovered that I test really well. Give me a challenge. How fast can you type? Show me your shorthand. Whatever you want to have me do, just tell me it's a test and I'll do it really well. I walked out with that thing on a Nikkor reel and they could not believe I did it. And a whole layer of distrust went away because they weren't sure they could do it. That was just to open the door. This was a photo lab. We had film coming in from all over the world. It was all film. We had agents using cameras that weren't cameras, didn't look like cameras, didn't really act like cameras. We were using a lot of film from Rochester, New York, specially designed for us, special sizes, special emulsions. There were films that if you didn't use this particular recipe to develop that film, what you would get is a roll of film would come out of the dark room that looked like somebody had opened the camera and exposed the whole thing. That was so that if somebody tried to develop one of our agents' roll of film, A, he wouldn't get any intelligence, and B, there would be a reason why it all turned black. It just went on and on. It was really interesting.
How do you figure out how to fit a camera into some of these items? I mean, that process has to be really difficult.
We had a camera.
Because they can't be detectable. They have to be very surreptitious, right?
They do. The most famous, now the most famous, back then the most classified camera concealment we had was to put one in a pen. And we would put them in big fat ink pens, like a Mont Blanc pen. Cost, even back then, $600. It was a status symbol. We didn't give these out willy-nilly. We gave these out to our assets who could get right up to the desk. So I always say, in today's world, we would want someone in Putin's inner circle who could walk up to Putin's desk and talk to him, maybe take some notes, have a notepad, have his Mont Blanc pen taking notes, and Putin turns his head or steps away or takes a phone call, whatever. Putin's not looking. Our agent could take his pen that he's writing with, hold it over the document on Putin's desk. Might be the minutes of the meeting, might be the agenda of the meeting. With one touch, silent, one finger, snap a photograph of that document. Putin turns back around. He makes another note. This gets to the heart of, you know, what were we collecting? We were always, and even today, we still are looking for information on the plans and the intentions of this country's enemies. That's the baseline. That's what you want. What are they going to do? So in today's terms, what's going on with China and North Korea? What are they going to do? What is Putin going to do regarding Ukraine? What is all of these countries that are sort of wobbling on the edge? What's next? If we had those pens still out there, we'd be collecting information on that subject. I believe we do have today's equivalent of that capability out there. I just don't know what form it has taken.
Much more digital, right? I mean, everything is...
It's probably digital. It's probably digital. Maybe everything is not digital. I don't know. I'm not there. I don't have a need to know. They're never going to tell me. I would kill to know. They're still not going to tell me. But you want to get the information and get it back to our policymakers so they can make smart decisions, informed decisions. So when you keep breaking it down like that, I had a conversation with one of our old timers at CIA. Because I've always said those pens were, those cameras and the pens were our best tool during the Cold War. And he would say, you know, we had those satellite systems, remember? All the satellites up there. We had overhead photography going on. We were dropping huge canisters, 60 miles of film in a canister. A plane would come and swoop it up. We knew we didn't need just those pens. And I always said, those pictures you're talking about, whether they're satellite or aerial reconnaissance, they're showing you today. That's what's there today. That's how many submarines are in that submarine bay today. That's how many rockets they're installing in Cuba. But back then, we wanted to know tomorrow. What are they going to do tomorrow? What are they going to do next? We're looking forward. The agenda, the minutes, what they're planning, not what they've got going on, what's coming. It was a big difference.
These are some of the stories that you'll hear in the book In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. Jonah Mendez is the author, and she is my guest, chief of disguise for the CIA and a best-selling co-author of Argo. I mean, it's a long resume here. I can't do the resume all hour, but she's here as a guest of the World Affairs Council in Rochester, and it's an honor to have Jonah Mendez here. I want to transition now to talk a little bit about how you build someone's face. And, you know, how good we are at that now, how that comes about. Can you take me through that?
You know, what I can tell you is how good we were.
Yeah, sure. Okay, fair enough. I'm sure we're great at it still.
Usually things go forward, not backwards.
Yeah, I would think so.
I tend to agree with you. So you want to talk about masks?
Absolutely.
Okay. We started years ago, working with Hollywood using stunt double masks. They're very simple. You know, Brad Pitt is going to get on the horse, but he's not going to ride off into the sunset. Some stuntman's going to ride off into the sunset. So these were kind of coarse from a distance with the right lighting. They looked really good. That was the beginning of our mask technology. That came from a man named John Chambers, who won an Oscar for his mask that he used in Planet of the Apes. It was a long time, CIA wouldn't let us talk about John Chambers, but they changed their mind. So we can honor him every time we bring up this subject. We moved from, we didn't want to make monkey masks. We wanted to make full face masks. That was our goal. So with John Chambers' help, we set down a path. He had in his workshop out in Hollywood some aluminum molds of some famous movie stars. One of them was Rex Harrison. I'll think of a couple of others. We had three. We had large, medium, and small. Rex Harrison was large. And these were static masks that looked like, let's talk about Rex Harrison. It looked exactly like Rex Harrison. We could make a blank of his face, and then we could play with it. It could be an Indian out in New Delhi. It could be an African-American in South Africa. We could turn it into anything, into anyone, and we could change not just ethnicities, but we could change gender. And I have to tell you that Rex Harrison makes an ugly, ugly woman. It doesn't matter how much lipstick you put on him. It doesn't get better. The good thing was that Rex Harrison never knew we were doing that. The other good thing is most places we used it didn't know it was Rex Harrison, so we didn't have to feel bad about it. But that was, for a while, that was the state of the art. That was called an overhead mask. Didn't move. It was uncomfortable inside, but, you know, it served a purpose. I remember in one of our books we talked about a border crossing at night in a diplomatic-plated car with two people with the appropriate IDs going through a guarded checkpoint. And one of them was wearing an overhead mask, and they got waved through. It served its purpose. But we wanted to make it better. So we went to something called a semi-animated mask, which was we went back to the half mask, and this would always have a beard and a mustache. The top half was a mask. The hair goods, whether it was the wig that was attached or the beard and the mustache, we kind of flesh it out. Bear in mind that these were all for men. We had, in my career, I don't remember doing a mask for a woman because we didn't have any female operations officers. And you know, when you're working with men and you're doing disguise, there's always a little bit of resistance. Men don't like to wear disguise. They don't want to wear wigs. They really, really don't want to glue on a mustache. There came a point when the world changed and we started working against counter-narcotics targets, against terrorism targets. And all of a sudden, our disguise technologies took on a new meaning. Now, they're not just a vehicle for denial. It wasn't me. I wasn't there. Now they are body armor. like, I don't care if you have a gun. I'm not an American. I'm one of you. Don't shoot me. The whole nature of disguise was changing. But it still wasn't good enough. It wasn't good enough. And so we had a goal of making a full-face animated mask. This was a long-term goal. This was lots of R&D. We worked with outside contractors. We tried all kinds of materials. It had to move. It had to be lifelike. It had to be wearable. You had to be able to keep it on for a period of time. And so we came up with the very first one. I was chief of disguise at that time. This was the end of a long, long R&D program. I'm chief of disguise. They gave me an African-American male mask that fit me and only me. It was custom made to my features. I put it on. I could sit here and talk to you, and you would not know that it was a mask. And I had gloves to match, really beautiful latex gloves with the veining painted in. It was good. So I wore it and showed it to the director of my office, and he liked it so much. He said, this is just great. Let's take it to the director of CIA, and we did that. We went up to the seventh floor. Bill Webster was running CIA back then. Showed it to Bill Webster. He loved it. He said, we're going to the White House. And all of a sudden, I'm like, well, now hold on. Hold on. This is good for on the street. This is good to consider in worldwide operations. But if we're going through the Secret Service into the Oval Office, I'm not going to walk in there as an African-American man. I don't walk like one. I don't talk like one. And we should do something a little less forward-leaning. So we made mask number two of these full-face masks, these animated masks, and turned me into a different woman, a kind of Latina woman. Her name was Becky. Because Becky, if you're listening, you probably never knew that we made that we made your face be my first mask. I really liked the way I looked
amazing.
As Becky. And we did. We took it to the White House. We went in with the presidential daily brief. Bill Webster went in. Webster went in first. John Sununu was there. Bob Gates was there. Brent Scowcroft was there. And I was there. Or Becky was there. And so I sat on the far right of a horseshoe in front of his office because I was going to brief him first, and then I was going to leave first. And I told the president, who had been the director of CIA at one point, I gave him some pictures of him. When he was director, we had done some disguise work for him, and he liked that. That kind of loosened him up. He's like, oh, yeah, I remember that. That was great. I loved what you guys did. You know, this is a little salesmanship here. And then I said, and you know, we've come a lot further now, and I'm wearing the latest thing we've got. And he's looking at my feet, like, where's the stuff? Where's the bag? I said, I've got it on. I'm going to take it off and show it to you. I didn't say it's a mask. And I started to, he said, hold on, stop, wait. And he got up and he came and he walked around and he's looking. I don't know what he thought he was looking for. Maybe he thought he was looking for a fake nose. I don't know what. But he couldn't see anything. So he sat back down. He said, okay, take it off. And I took it off and I held it up to show him how beautiful it was and how light it was. And so John Sununu, who was sitting next to me, but not listening to me, because he was going to talk next, and he had his cards, and he was making notes. He was crossing something out. He's writing something in. Wasn't looking. He looked up, and he made this little squeaky noise when he saw me holding my head up in the air, which gave me great joy. Bush really liked it. This was President George H.W. Bush. I never saw him so sparkly, so... He was kind of lit up. He liked this. He was enthusiastic. He was pleased to see what we were doing. And having done my bit, I left the office first. Tony had said, my husband Tony Mendez, who had been in the Oval Office, he said, make sure you know what door you come in because you want to go out that same door. He said, the door to the left, I think it's a broom closet. There's another door. Not sure where that goes. Don't go there. go out the door you came in. So I did that. And I went to the outer office, and there was the dog and the puppies. That was Millie's puppies. And I'm down on the floor playing with puppies. And the photographer came out of the Oval Office and said, so what was that? And I said, well, you photographed it. I know you saw it. She said, yeah, but what was it? Now, she's using a film camera, so she can't, like, click back to that frame.
Sure.
I said, I can't tell you because it's classified. So I think I ticked her off because it took 10 years for them to send me that picture. It did take 10 years.
Is that right?
And they airbrushed the mask out. So in my office, for many years in my office at home, I had a picture of my moment in the Oval Office sitting in front of the president's desk, and I'm holding my hand up in the air. They left me a finger. They took out the mask, just left me a finger. Looks like I'm lecturing him. And people would come in and say, what were you saying to him? And I say, I can't talk about it. It's classified. It's my favorite picture.
We're talking to Jonah Mendez, whose new book is called In True Face, and the former CIA chief of disguise, who, was it always a debate in your mind about whether you'd get to do field work if you wanted to? If you would always be designing masks for others, or if you were always going to be designing cameras for others, or if you would ever have the chance to do that for yourself?
Nope. I got out the door doing photography in Europe the first time around. They didn't want me doing that, but there was no one else there. It was like, can you do this? Yes, I can do this. I went and did that. And then I started traveling throughout Europe doing photography work. Loved that. What I discovered at CIA was it was hard to say no if they actually understood that you could do whatever it was you were representing.
And you just kept proving that you could do it.
Yeah. I would talk to some of the young women today. I didn't do this back then. I was not a great mentor, I got to say. But today I would tell young women, I do tell young women, you know, don't wait for them to offer whatever it is to you. Very gently take it. It doesn't have to be gentle, but just take it. Don't wait for them to give it to you. Reach out your hand and take it. When they walk in and they say, who wants to, before they finish a sentence, hand in the air, I do. I'll do it. Whatever it is, I'll do it. And that's a way to make your way forward with men who are hesitant to give you serious responsibilities.
Well, in so many ways, this book is your story, but it is not just your story. It's the story of what women have faced in this agency, right?
There's nothing that unique about my story. I think my story ended rather well. I don't think they all end rather well. I think some women just get tired of the grind of trying to push forward, finding out 10 years later that, of course, they didn't get promoted. Because to get promoted, they didn't know this, but in the promotion panel, these training courses were required. Oh, you didn't have them? That's why you were never promoted. Or you should, you know, they would assume that you couldn't go overseas because you were married or had kids, and they never told you that that was the assumption. There's so many subtle ways to just keep a lid on it, and they have done that. I used to think, I did think, seriously, that that at some point a new generation of young men was going to come into that agency. They would have been raised better. They would have understood more closely this woman thing. They'd be ready to help move women forward. My husband was like that. Tony, didn't matter if you were a woman or not. If you were capable, he would push you forward. But that cavalry never showed up. What did show up was a group of young women who came into the CIA. I know you can't swear on NPR, so I'm not going to, but who would not put up with that, you know what? They just would not. So there's a story in the book. I'm walking down the hallway with a brand new chemist. We're going to lunch. Crowded hallway. Here comes one of our audio guys. They were the ones that put in bugs. They're the third story guys. They're a little rough sometimes. He's walking toward us. He liked me anyway. But Trish was really, really cute. And he just starts talking to us while he's coming down the hall saying, oh, you beautiful babes. And Trish, brand new, kind of young, new generation, she says to me, what's his name? I said, his name is Bill. She turns to him. She just looks at him. She says in her loudest, loudest voice, "Bill, F off." Now, you really have to understand that. Really yelled in a big crowded hallway at CIA where people didn't talk like. Anyway, Bill never, to my knowledge, ever bothered anyone, including me, again. And I thought, it's the women. No more of these back rubs while you're sitting, you know, at your desk.
Ugh.
All of this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's gone, but I'm confident that it's going.
Text from Sarah to the program wants to know if there were political heroes or other women in Washington who leaned on each other.
Oh, yeah. My hero was a woman named Eloise Page, who, when I used to teach intelligence courses, I'd get these classes, maybe 50% women. And I'd say, who in this room knows who Eloise Page is? Nobody ever raised their hand. Nobody knew. I'd go out to some of the military offices, and one of them I found a big glass case full of pictures and citations and everything for Eloise Page. It's in the wrong building. Belongs in CIA. What it was doing out there, I don't know. So then when I taught those courses, I would suggest to those young women that they form a posse and that they go pick up that glass case and bring it home where it belongs. She was Bill Donovan's secretary. She was the highest ranking woman in CIA history for many, many years. She was the first chief of station. She just took the thing and ran with it. She was fabulous. She was a hero. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a hero for all that she did. And the book is dedicated to those two women. Just as an aside, I went to Kennedy Center over and over with a friend, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg would be there for opera. And the first time I saw her for an opera performance was in it's called the Russian Lounge. It's a place where you can have a cup of tea or a glass of champagne, and then you go into the opera. So they rang the bell. We all went into the opera. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, though, had come in about 10 minutes before. And Nina Totenberg of NPR fame was fetching her tea. So we went and sat down in the theater. Everybody's seated. The lights are down. The conductor is there with his baton. And then the lights started coming up. And we all turned around and looked. And here comes Ruth Bader Ginsburg down the aisle at the Kennedy Center, the Opera House, with an usher on each side, taking her to her seat. Everybody stood up and applauded. The whole place applauded. She sat down. They dim the lights. They start the opera. And I thought, oh, my God, that's the most beautiful thing I ever saw.
I thought you might bring this up here. This is how you conclude that portion of your book here. You write about Ruth Bader Ginsburg after that moment. This woman, this brilliant woman who had to fight the good fight before the glass ceiling even had a name, the Supreme Court justice who, on many levels, represented women in America and their struggle for equal treatment in the workplace. This powerful, petite woman made me tear up that night. I felt moved by her and Eloise Page and Jeanine Bruckner and the thousands of others who carved a path for the rest of us. I'm so grateful for my place on that path and for all the others who walk it behind me. You feel like there are women working right now who feel that way about you, I suspect.
I don't know. It'd be nice to think that, but I don't know that.
Are you being appropriately humble about this?
I'm being my mother's daughter.
We have a few more minutes with Jonah Mendez, who is the author of a new book called In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA, Unmasked. There are so many other stories that we could talk about. We could talk about what it's like to assume other identities and what it's like to, truly be in situations where if your work is not as precise as you want it to be, people's lives could be in danger. It's all in the book, and I would urge people to pick it up and read it and learn about what the CIA actually does. I mean, part of the theme of this conversation is how little the average American knows about what you and your colleagues have done. But I think that's part of the frustration that that you must feel, but also I think Americans feel. We don't really know what the CIA is doing. And when you hear some of the this silly is the wrong word, but kind of these outsized descriptions of what the CIA is doing. I'm sure it's frustrating for people on the inside. But how do we keep a check on it to make sure that the CIA, to make sure intelligence is behaving appropriately, especially because by the very nature of your work, the public can't know about it?
You know, that's been a question for many years. And for many years, there has been oversight put into place in the Congress where there are committees that review the very classified information that about what we're working on, why we're working on it, how we're working on it. And they have caught some things over the years to say, hold on a minute, just a second. Is that, do we need to do that? Is that, that worked for, I would say, a rather long time until today, when everything is politicized and nothing is sacred and nothing is absolutely true. And you can't trust that you find the truth. The truth now varies. This is my truth, and over here, this is my truth. And here, we're sitting behind a curtain where our truth cannot be made public because people's lives will be on the line. Do you remember Valerie Plame?
Of course.
When she was outed? I didn't know her back then, but I knew that once her name came out as a CIA agent, that around the world, all the countries that she would have visited and all the people that she would have been met with will be now under some scrutiny. Why were they meeting with a CIA officer? She was not traveling as a CIA officer. It put a whole bunch of people in jeopardy, just almost whimsically, you know?
For political point scoring.
For political point scoring. Yeah. And when that becomes the when that becomes the rationale for why you're doing what you're doing, you have to retrench, you have to go back and start again. But this is not just with the CIA. This is, I think, politically, this is across the board. So many things that we think we know are questioned, so many things that we believe are true turn out not to be.
Well, this is a little bit of where I wanted to kind of conclude. And I don't want to dive too deep into politics. In fact, there's so much that's refreshing about this book. You know, the various administrations that you served, that Tony served, that it wasn't about a deep political examination. I mean, it was about serving a country. So here we are, and there's a lot of distrust sowed in institutions now. I am not an expert in this matter, but my observation is, you brought up Putin, you brought up autocrats like him. They benefit from a public not trusting institutions, in reflexively not trusting their own government, not trusting reality in general. Are we playing into the hands of the people that you worked against over the years by going down this road?
Like you, I don't like to get political at all. And I would point out that while I was working, it's hard to believe in today's world, I didn't know who was a Republican and who was a Democrat in my office. It never came up. It didn't really matter who was president, because at our level, at the working level, the work continues on. The goals remain the same. The targets remain the same. The collection of intelligence remained the same for whoever was running our government, whoever was in charge. It's hard now to accept the fact that that's not the way it is anymore, that politics are very much a part of it. I was reading in the paper this morning about two new appointees to the Oversight Committee, the Intelligence Committee in the Senate. And there's a huge brouhaha in Washington, D.C., because these two people that have been appointed are far-right Republican politicians. And the concern is that they can be disruptive, that they can skew the results, that this is, you know, you want on these committees, on this is like the heart of our government, and you want reasonable, reputable, intelligent people making decisions, not not to interfere with what's going on, but to help guide what is going on. I'm not sure how we get back from that, but I think we need to. It's a goal.
It's a very good goal to have. In the meantime, maybe these are the kind of guideposts to remind Americans, especially now, that it didn't always used to be this way. And there's something hopeful about that. There's also, you're a phenomenal storyteller. I laughed out loud a number of times. there's a lot of very serious, seriously natured things in this book, but boy, are you good. And we didn't even get to talk about Argo. Come back again, we'll talk about she said Argo's years ago. My guest is the co-author of Argo, but the author of In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. Jonah Mendez's book is, I think it's an important document, and I'm grateful that you're here to tell the story. Thank you very much.
You do a phenomenal interview. Thank you.
It's great having Jonah Mendez. And all right, let's take a break. We've got more connections coming up in just a moment.